This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
7:35 in the morning, you are listening to The Morning Run with Shazana Chuang and Philip. For now, though, we are turning our attention to the beautiful game, which is showing its ugly side. English football is at risk of more financial chaos following a report published by former UK Sports Minister Tracy Crouch, which found that despite the wealth in the Premier League, teams across the English game have fallen into administration 62 times since the top tier was founded in 1992. The sport is supposedly at a crossroads now.
So more broadly, European football has also been desperate for cash and has grown more acute after the pandemic kept crowds away from stadiums, left some of the continent's biggest and most successful clubs with eye-watering debt, most notably Barcelona, who had to sell Lionel Messi because they couldn't afford his humongous wages. That financial pressure was also the catalyst behind the failed breakaway Super League in April this year, and of course a slew of foreign investors pumping capital into these struggling football clubs. So the injection, the question is, has the injection of foreign investment affected the game?
And how will clubs have to reorientate themselves in a world without packed stadiums? Speaking to us this morning, weighing in on this particular issue, is Professor Simon Chadwick, Director of the Centre for Eurasian Sport at Emlyon Business School. Thanks for joining us, Simon. Good morning. So what are the various current issues with the way things are run in top-level football leagues at the moment? Can you give us a lay of the land?
So I think for European football leagues in general, there is an issue of uncertainty of outcome. For those who don't understand or are not familiar with this term, uncertainty of outcome is that one of the principles of sport and of sports leagues is that really we shouldn't know who's going to win, because many people engage with football because of this uncertainty of outcome. What we find is that in most leagues, and I think particularly of Germany, for instance, where Bayern Munich tends to win the league every year, we don't have uncertainty of outcome. And that very often is brought about by competitive imbalance. And competitive imbalance is the consequence of, you know, very often clubs having more money or having better players or constantly being able to acquire the best talent ahead of other clubs. And so I think for Europeans in general, there is this concern that rather than there really being uncertainty of outcome and equality and competitive balance, what we do have is a sport that is increasingly dominated by a very small number of very large and powerful organizations.
How has foreign ownership changed football, and do you think there should be restrictions on them?
What we've got to keep in mind is many of the foreign ownerships are not necessarily big money, big success, signing lots of players, dominating leagues. There are many foreign owners out there who are small investors. Their clubs, they've run them in a very efficient way. I'm thinking about, for instance, Barnsley in the English Championship, which is owned by foreign investors, and yet Barnsley has not tried to spend its way to success. The owners have tried to run the club in a very efficient and effective way. But clearly what we do have is we've got some foreign owners that appear intent more on generating revenues for the purposes of their businesses. And I'm thinking, for instance, of Manchester United, which is owned by American investors. But we also have the likes of Paris Saint-Germain and Manchester City, owned by Middle Eastern states. And so what we do have, and this phrase has been used, some people have referred to it as financial doping, whereby essentially these clubs, courtesy of their very powerful, very rich owners, are able to spend lots of money on pretty much everything, ranging from the stadiums they have to the training grounds that they develop, right through to obviously spending big money in terms of salaries and transfer fees for players.
Yeah, now, Professor, of course, you talked about Manchester United, the American owners, the Glazers. The concern is that they're more interested in their share price than success in the league. Is this the start of the downfall of football, though, when profits trump sporting achievements?
Well, you've got to keep in mind the Glazers have been there for 16 years. And prior to that, Manchester United had been a public limited company floated on the London Stock Exchange. So we're talking about, in terms of those two sets of owners, a club that really has been operating for the last 30 years on the basis of profits rather than other considerations. And yet Manchester United is still there. Football is still there. So I don't think we're on the cusp of the downfall of football. What I think we are on the cusp of is the polarization of football. And this polarization is significant because clearly there are people in the world who they like and they want this kind of big money, very glamorous, very powerful clubs that are omnipotent across the world. I guess just as many of us would go to eat in McDonald's, you know, many of us, you know, we like Real Madrid and we like Manchester United. But I think there are significant numbers of people out there in the world who want a different kind of football. They want the kind of football that perhaps they remember when they were younger, when they were children, whereby clubs have a very strong link with local communities, where clubs put performance, playing performance ahead of financial performance. And even just yesterday, proposals were revealed in England to designed essentially to retrieve the situation that we now find ourselves in, whereby big clubs and big money, big owners, possibly from overseas are dominating and supporters are losing out. So we've had a fan-led review in England, and what appears to be the case is that there is a determination to ensure that fans remain important and that they have a say in their clubs, and that it isn't just all about money, it is about community and fandom and identity and locality.
And how do you think the pandemic has altered the economics of football clubs, especially without stadium ticket sales and over-reliance on broadcasters?
There is no doubt that the pandemic has altered the economics of football. My view before we went into the pandemic is the rich would get richer and the poor would get poorer. And that is exactly what has happened. I think some of the larger organizations, perhaps drawing their money from, for example, Middle Eastern states, have been able to endure throughout the pandemic in a way that other clubs haven't. Obviously, we've got to keep in mind that all clubs, no matter who or what they do, suffered as a consequence of not being able to generate revenues from ticket sales because fans have been banned from stadiums. So I think that's all part of it. But at the same time, too, I think the bigger organizations have had the financial resilience to be able to continue to search for big sponsors, to continue to target fans overseas, have had the sophisticated merchandising operations. The social media teams who've been able to maintain engagement with fans across the world. And so they've not only been able to maintain their pre-pandemic position, but I think also to strengthen their pre-pandemic position. And so what we do have, I think, right now is a very, very polarized sport.
How concerned are you that the whole drama over the Super League might reemerge again?
The Super League will come back again. And the Super League proposals that we saw earlier in the year, this is not the first time we've seen it. And really, the last time we'd seen it was back in 2007. And in 2007, this coincided with the Champions League, the UEFA Champions League being redesigned. And the bigger clubs wanted a larger share of the revenues. And so the story about a breakaway began to simmer in 2007. Exactly the same scenario this year. UEFA is considering, the reformatting of its Champions League, more commercial revenue, more coverage on TV, and so on and so forth. And the bigger clubs wanted to make a play for that. So partly the Super League was a consequence of that UEFA decision. So UEFA will reformat the Champions League again at some stage, maybe not for another decade. One would imagine if football still exists in the format that it is at the moment, the Super League conversation will come back in that context. But irrespective of the reformatted Champions League, we know that those larger clubs, they believe that they're the ones who generate the most revenues for football. They're the ones who believe that they are the most commercially powerful and engaging across the world. And they don't want to share. They don't believe that it is their responsibility to take care of smaller clubs. And so I referred to the English fan-led review. One of the mechanisms, it appears, that the British government wants to put in place is, for instance, a transfer tax. So the more money you spend on transfers, the more tax you pay, and then that tax will be allocated to smaller clubs lower down the league pyramid. So there is a concern that about polarization. There are measures now being developed to address the polarization. But in some ways, it may well be that this just hastens the travel towards a Super League because bigger clubs may not be happy with this luxury tax.
Simon, thanks very much for speaking to us this morning. That was Professor Simon Chadwick, Director of the Center for Eurasian Sport at Emlyon Business School, talking to us about the economics of football and how the pandemic has really changed the direction of the debate, or at least hastened some trends quicker than it used to be.
Yeah, that whole rich-poor divide has been a real presence in the Premiership in England. And it's really a reflection of what happened with F1 many years ago, when the richest, wealthy teams were able to win the championship year in, year out. But the thing is, this hand-wringing over the lack of equality in the sport, it kind of impedes on the whole concept of hierarchies. And hierarchies is something that human beings and all living creatures have, understand since time immemorial, right? I think it's unrealistic to expect that hierarchies don't exist in sport or in life per se. We know where we stand in society. But I just want to say one more thing as well. Just in terms of a pure sporting spectacle, the Premiership is an amazing one to behold at this point in time. You've got the best coaches in the land, in the world, the best players in the world in the Premiership, and week in, week out, they provide this amazing spectacle for all to see.
All right, you sound like a true blue fan there, Chuan.
It's a respite from all the nonsense.
A respite from the nonsense indeed. All right, stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.